90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today, we start our Women's History Month for the month of March, where we celebrate the achievements and continue to fight for women's rights. And before I bring our guest on, I'm going to tell a little bit about her. She is Christine Taylor Butler, an attorney, and she is a graduate of MIT, and she is a phenomenal person who has been an advocate, an author, and achieved many things. Good morning, Christine. Are you with us this morning?
I am, and I'm not an attorney. I just stayed at the Holiday Inn Express one day. I'm a retired engineer.
So, good morning. Welcome back. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? Are you originally from the Kansas City metropolitan area?
I am not. I'm Midwest. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and then went away from high school and college, and met the man of my dreams, which is Ken. And he was not a Boston person, and I was by then. And he got a job in Kansas City, and you know, I was in love, and we were getting married, and so. Yes, the honeymoon was driving a U-Haul truck across the country to our new hometown. But I've lived in Kansas City longer than I've lived any place else.
I hope that experience wasn't like the Rich Pryor movie Moving, where there was just one calamity after another.
Oh, I have to tell you this one story. We were towing my car behind the truck, and his car was left in Boston because I was going to go back. And you know, it was this Nissan Sentra, and we are going down a hill on the highway headed towards Kansas City, and I see my car driving in the next lane, and we panicked because we thought my car had detached from the truck and was rolling down the street, and then it turned out to be another car. But yeah, it was an adventure driving all our stuff across country, but you know, we're here, and we're safe.
So, where did you attend high school? I know you've got some, attended a high school with some very famous people and prominent people now attended high school.
Well, I was going to a gifted program in Cleveland, Ohio, and I was creative about being a thorn in the school side, and there was a boarding school that recruited there every year for kids in that school, Phillips Exeter Academy. And, you know, we were a predominantly black school. And I ended up going to Exeter for high school. And, you know, so a lot of people have gone there. Mark Zuckerberg, who, you know, obviously went there long after I went there. Dan Brown as a graduate. But, yeah, I went to high school in New Hampshire.
So, Christine, what did you want to be when you were young growing up?
I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a storyteller and a writer and do creative, artistic things. But, you know, when you're growing up in the inner city, you know, that's not something that's always encouraged by the community. You know, mostly it's about, you know, get a reliable job, a long-term job. And so I ended up pursuing engineering.
Well, to piggyback on that a little bit, what can parents do to prepare their child to get the best education possible? Because I know you're also an education advocate.
Yeah. You know, I'm well known for when my children are like 27 and 32 now. But when my kids were in the Kansas City Public School District, I was always, you know, advocating for a better education. And we switched to a charter school, which was not only not better, it was worse. And so I would, you know, so, you know, we went back to the public school district and I said, you know, there's a couple of things is I don't care whether kids go to college. I don't. I care that they qualify because if they qualify, you know, especially for a high-end college, then they are making choices about their life. They're not taking what's left over. And so I said, you should prepare the kids like they're going to an elite college because, you know, the reading skills are the same, even if you want to be an auto mechanic, you know, that what I was finding, I interviewed for MIT for about 30 years and I ran the region here for quite a while. And I said, what I was finding is, especially in the Kansas City area, parents were coming up to me in 11th grade and saying that my kid is interested in a school like MIT. And then I would look at the prep work and I would have to be honest and say, that's not going to happen. And then at Lincoln Prep, which is where, you know, both my kids went for a while, they were encouraging kids to do the A-plus program and go to community college for 2 years then switch. And I said, if you switch, you're going to start over as a freshman. You know, nothing about community college is going to qualify for freshman classes at, you know, or sophomore classes. So what I told the school district is parents don't know, but it's your job to know what are the qualifications these kids are going to need for UMKC or KU or MIT or USC, you know, that we need to know up front. What are all the possible variables we need to provide for these kids so that when they're making decisions, they have choices? Does that make sense?
No, that makes sense. Let me ask this question. So how important is it for your child to be academically prepared, not just for college, but for, my belief, middle school and high school, where a lot of the work needs to be done to prepare your child to be able to have that opportunity to be accepted to any college?
Okay, so what we say a lot of times is that, you know, from zero to third grade, you are learning to read. Above third grade, you are reading to learn. And what I was finding is there are a lot of kids in the Kansas City area that are still at the third and fourth grade reading level in high school, and their parents don't know any better. And you know, I'm an engineer. My husband's a biologist. We had a kid with a post-high school vocabulary who came out of a charter school, barely able to read. And we hadn't noticed because, she, you know, she has a mouth on her. I don't know if you've met her when you were on a school board. And so we put her in JS Chick, which doesn't exist anymore, and they were pulling her out 1 or 2 hours a day to get her up to speed because the charter school, which was Brookside at the time, taught no decoding skills, none. You know, they it turns out they didn't even have a curriculum. So parents have to be on top of this because I'll give you another example. I used to go to Lincoln Prep all the time and sit in on classes and notice that, especially in classes like algebra, a lot of times the teachers couldn't teach the subject. And I watched a young girl get really frustrated with the class, and the teacher threw her out and didn't know I was a parent and said, you know what, she's really disruptive. And I said, you threw the smartest kid in the class out of the class. She's bored. She needs to be in a gifted class. And she says, well, how do you know that? And I said, well, okay, it's an eighth grade class or ninth grade class. I can't remember which one. And I said, the question was 3 times 3 times 3. And all the kids were screaming for a calculator. She had, every time you put a problem up, she had the question answered in like 30 seconds. I said, she's the brightest kid in the class. So, you know, fast forward, you know, my youngest kid is now in Lincoln Prep and we are, you know, we're helping at home. And she gives up. She says, I'm done. I want to leave. And she gets into a school in Connecticut. And the first thing they said was, you know, she's a straight A student. She's advanced on all the end of course exams. Her training is appalling. And Olivia said, yeah, I'll never get into college if I stay in the Kansas City School District. So, you know, that was years ago. She's 27 now. But I tell parents, you can't rely on any school, not even a private school. We did St. Teresa's. St. Teresa's was not any better. You cannot rely on any school to tell you what your kid needs. You have to go out and find out what your kid needs and then demand the school provide it.
That was one of the things that got me to the school board as a parent, then of four children in the district. It was critical to attend parent-teacher conference and find out, you know, I was in the schools, but it told me what my children needed to work on and, you know, being there, because if you don't know what you don't know, and, you know, a lot of people work, but you've got that one day a year, a quarter, where you can go up and find out that information. But now it's a lot easier because you can communicate with the teachers, you know, online, email, all these different things.
Right.
So
right.
It's a lot easier than it was then, because I remember I would start out early, four children, three different schools, and 24 teachers, and I would be there starting at one and finish up one. I'd go to the school where I had the most children first and then go to the next school and go from there, but it was critical. But you mentioned something earlier, and I want to piggyback on that. How important is it for your child to be able to read?
Okay, so reading is everything. And it's not a coincidence that I left my job in engineering at Hallmark to become a writer. I was seeing two things. One is I was either seeing really gifted kids interviewing for college who only read whatever was given to them in class. You know, they weren't proactively going to the library or and then I was seeing the kids who could not read. And it is really hard to tell parents or community activists who are really excited about a kid's potential that a lot of the doors are temporarily closed to them because they're not reading at the level they need to be, or they're reading to regurgitate. And I was really good as an interviewer in ferreting out which kids were the ones who were like, you know, Mrs. Taylor Butler, I've got to tell you about this thing I was doing, and I went to the library and could intelligently discuss a book. And, you know, I read a lot. My husband reads a lot. And he was interviewing for UMKC Medical School. And we would find the kids who would come in and bluff. And, you know, we're well-read. So we would ask really pointed questions about the book they claimed to read. And they couldn't answer them. And I said, you know, the reason why you want to read independently is there's a lot of talk radio. There's a lot of news. There's a lot of politicians telling you and interpreting for you what is going on in daily events. And you need to be able to read the ballot. You need to be able to read your mortgage contract. You need to be able to read the manual for how to fix the engine in the car. Reading is the basis of everything. That is why in foreign countries, groups like the Taliban don't want schools. They don't want people to read. They want to be able to tell you what to think, not have you be able to determine what to think because you go out and get the information for yourself.
So, Christine, how important is it for parents to expand their child's view beyond their block in the city in which they live in? I know you did something unique with your daughter that people may have given you flack for, but it helped set her up down the road for extremely incredible, successful activities.
Oh, I got a lot of shade. I got a lot of shade for the things we did with our kids. Okay, so I live right in Midtown. You know, I'm not living out in the suburbs. And when I grew up in Cleveland, I didn't even know that you were allowed to go out of the country. You know, I didn't have anybody in my neighborhood that did things like that. And then my mom became very activist, and I remember she went to Spain for the first time. It was her first time on a plane. The pilot figured it out. Everyone's applauding. And so as we were growing up, you know, I told my husband when I met him, had also not been traveling, and he had an opportunity to go to Mexico with one of his professors for 3 months, and his parents were adamant that he not do it. And I said, well, you should do it anyway. How would they know? So he did. You know, he went and had to become immersed in Spanish. And so we tried to do that with our kids, and Alexis did people-to-people. She went to Japan. And then Olivia, which is my youngest, you know, she went away to boarding school. And she had done, like, the Lincoln Prep band trips where they'd go to Mexico on a carnival cruise. But she went to high school in Connecticut. And one of the opportunities when she was there was you could spend a year in a foreign country. And she had been learning Latin since she had been at Lincoln Prep. And she got into an Italian program and lived there for a year and came back fluent in Italian. And here's why that's important. Once that happened, that school also did a band trip to the Czech Republic. My oldest daughter was at KCAI, the Art Institute, and they did the Czech Republic for 5 weeks. When it comes time for job interviews or college interviews, or I don't care what it is, you're going up against a lot of other people who want that job. And I always say be interesting, and be interesting in a way that it's something that you're passionate about. So the example that I gave you was there is, you know, I have a daughter in film, and there is an opportunity to join NBC's PAGE program where you rotate through four business departments over the course of a year. And they get 4,000 applications for 25 spots in New York and 12 spots in L.A., 4,000. And so you have to go through all these gauntlets. And so we said, you know, make sure all this stuff is on your resume. And she got through the first two steps. The third one was you had to give an example of a place that was important to you. And you had 2 minutes to do it in front of the executives with no props, no PowerPoint. So we said, do Italy. You lived in this old medieval town, you know, that's 2 hours north of Rome. Do Italy. And then, you know, ended in fluent Italian. And so at the end of the, you know, they had narrowed it down to 40 candidates. At the end of her presentation, they told all the candidates, thanks, you did a good job. We're going to spend some time thinking about this because there's only 12 spots. We will let you know next week. They called her that night and offered her one of the spots. And they had 12 spots open. They only took 9. And so for all those parents who were giving me shade about, I don't know how you let your 15-year-old go live in Italy for a year. And I said, well, she's going with 60 other United States students. And these parents have been doing it for years. And this program's based out of Boston. The whole point is you come back knowing more about the world. You come back not only fluent in a language, but you're fluent in the way other cultures think about us, the way they make decisions. You're not insulated to this is how Kansas City does it, therefore the rest of the world should just kind of follow suit. You come back more like a Swiss Army knife, I guess, is the way I think of it.
I can say this. For a young man who went to Central High School, which is in the heart of the city, and you know, we've had Olympians come out of there, we've had politicians come out of there, but a lot of the kids in the neighborhood never go far past that block. And when I signed up for the military, I was able to see things in the world that I'd only seen in books. I got to go to Verona, home of Romeo and Juliet. I've been to Venice. I've been to Venice many times. I've been to Milan. I've seen the Leaning Tower of Pisa when they were counterbalancing it. Once you've been that far away from home, when you come back, it's like a total different mindset. You've got, you know, I was lucky. I was able to spend 7.5 months in Europe, you know, just doing things and learning, you know, but just going around the world, you know, when I was in Saudi Arabia and I've been to Kuwait, been to Bahrain, different things. You get to see a total different world. And it's like, it's that TV show, It's a Different World, once you come back, because you can relate to so many other things So, you know, if you're a parent, you know, look at maybe finding those different ways, you know, and if you're a student, you know, you may not have much money. You know, I was torn joining the military, but it's just different ways, but it worked out well for me. So, but as you said, sometimes get them off the block and out of the city and let them see so much more, and they will be more well-rounded. So,
well, and exactly, and I will tell you, there's a private school, I won't mention the name of it, but every time I interviewed their kids, you know, they would go to China or they would go to the Dominican Republic. And, you know, so I would say, okay, you went and you were in this different environment. You know, they go for a week or they go for 2 weeks. And none of those kids could tell me what that experience was. You know, they talk about the food. You know, one student talked about the smog in China. And I said, but the culture and the language barriers, and how did you navigate that? Knowing that when my daughter did People to People, she was in Japan, and part of that is you have a host family stay, and they would even have code words. If you felt like you were uncomfortable or there was something that you felt you need to talk about, you could call one of the counselors and say, happy birthday. You know, they would always have these codes that would, you know, mean somebody needs to get over to the house. And so there were all these things, and my daughter was talking about the music and the food and the language barrier. So I'm interviewing these kids from local schools who have had all these privileges, and none of them was, it was just another thing to put on a resume for them. You know, just another thing a parent needs to do. And then the parents will call and say, you know, I'm really shocked my kid didn't get into your school. And I said, I don't know why you would be. You know, there were just better qualified kids. And you can't say it's because the whole point of doing these things is tell me what it was like having to navigate a foreign airport. You know, tell me what it was like to do X, Y, and Z. You know, it's nerve-wracking to do those things for the first time, or to clear customs for the first time, or to get your passport. And now these kids can talk about that because some adult was doing it for them. So, you know, what we're saying is, you know, frankly, I don't care if a kid's going to Iowa. Let's give kids independent things, a summer camp. The Girl Scouts used to do a summer camp. And they moved it to Warrensburg 1 year. It was an engineering camp. And the parents were still showing up to spy and be close. And what we're looking for is who are those students can do their own laundry and cook their own meals and navigate the world without a helicopter parent or teacher holding their hand the whole time is the biggest problem I'm finding in the Midwest compared to the coast.
So, Christine, you graduated from MIT with a degree in civil engineering, and you also completed a second degree in art and design. What was it like being a woman attending MIT?
There weren't that many of us. There were so few. They had a room on the third floor, especially for women who were commuting in and not living on campus. And I lived in campus approved housing, but it was far enough away that I could have a code to this room, because there were days when you just needed to decompress. It was, for a very long time, a very male-centered university. It's a lot different now than it was then. But, you know, honestly, it was no different than navigating the rest of the world. When I wanted to go to MIT, I had a math teacher, Mr. Havenhill, in eighth grade, who was ex-military, and he said, you know, you're the only kid who does the extra credit things that I throw out, and you would love this school, MIT. Well, in Cleveland, MIT, Michigan. I didn't know anything about MIT. Nobody talked about MIT or Harvard or any of those schools in Cleveland. And I kind of got, you know, kind of got interested, and back then there was no internet, so you're going to the library and looking things up. And then I would say, you know what, I think I'm going to apply to MIT. And I had all manner of people, it wasn't even race-based, saying, you know, why would you want to do that? I mean, as a woman, once you get married, that would be a waste. You know, that was a very common thing I heard. Then when I moved here and started working at Hallmark, I had employees tell me the same thing, that that their parents thought college was a waste on a girl. So, I had to fight that stereotype to get to MIT, and then my younger sister also went to MIT.
So, Christine, you've worked for Hallmark. You're an author. What are some of the other things you did in between prior to you following your childhood dream?
Oh, you want me to out myself. Okay. So I grew up in Cleveland, and my parents were teenagers. And so we lived with my grandparents, after they got married. We lived with my maternal grandparents for a very long time. And my grandfather had a furnace business that all the brothers were part of. And my mom was the only girl, so she was a little spoiled. But we were in walking distance of Case Western Reserve University, which is where my dad went to get his chemistry degree. And then we were in walking distance of the art museum. Cleveland has a really good art museum. And so my mom found things for us to do. We were always in the library. And then as we got older, she ended up doing women's rights things, and there was a group called Cleveland Women Working that she was a part of. And they are actually the inspiration for the movie 9 to 5. And so I was raised by this activist mom because, it was, the middle of the civil rights era. And so one of the things I did is we didn't have a lot of money when my parents first got their first house, a small house. We went to Gracemont Elementary, and the Cleveland School District did not allow girls to wear pants. And, Cleveland has brutal winters, so, you could wear, no pants, but once you got to school, you had to take them off. And every year, at the beginning of the school year, we had this tiny little budget to go get a new school outfit and to get school supplies. And it was so small, we had to get those wax crayons. We couldn't afford the Crayola crayons. And so we could pick out one outfit, one new school outfit. And we went to a place that was like Value City. And my sister picked out a navy blue pantsuit, and it was cute, and it had flowers, and it had lace, and she wore it to the first day of school, and she got sent home because pants weren't allowed. And I was incensed, and so I talked to the teachers, and they said, well, it was a school board policy, and the principal wouldn't budge. So my mom said, you could always start a petition, and I said, well, what's that? So I got clipboards, and I hand-wrote out these, petitions. And we had just about every kid in the school taking those petitions around their neighborhood to get adult signatures. And then during recess, we had protest marches and posters, and we embarrassed the school district. And the teachers wouldn't sign it because they thought they would lose their job, but we embarrassed the school district, who changed the policy. So women and girls could now wear pants. We're not talking about blue jeans. We're talking about, nice pants. We changed the policy, and that's been my way of working ever since.
So embarrassing school districts by having peaceful protests is something that you've been doing, it seems like, for all your life.
Oh, that's why I campaigned over the property tax issue. Is the news says, could you afford the new tax? And I said, we'd have to figure out how to put that in the budget. But the question is fairness. That I don't want to pay a tax for more value than I actually have. But also, I had elderly neighbors who were at risk of losing their homes. One actually was on the news crying because she had to sell her home because the assessor's office had been so mean, And I looked at my husband, and he says, yeah, this is an issue you want to tackle. So my family, it's more like civil rights. It's not you're doing it because it's unfair to you. You're doing it because it's unfair to everybody. So, so it's not just school districts, though. I have taken on the school district, and Olivia was on Debate KC, and she took on Covington in a public meeting, and I ended up on CNN, and she ended up getting $200,000 scholarships to go to high school someplace else because she had made the news. So that's, you know, she had wanted to go away anyway. She said, I can't be smart here. And so I raised her to stick up for herself. So even at her new school, she was the treasurer of an LGBT club, even though she's not LGBTQ. It's the right thing to do.
So we're talking with Christine Taylor Butler, author, MIT graduate, education activist, and education advocate, and we're talking about her life in regards to women's achievements and equality. So we're going to take a short break. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI. This is Kansas City's community radio station. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is a Women's History Moment from KKFI, the Ethnic Enrichment Commission, and Baraza African Culture Center. Wangari Maathai was born in Nyeri, Kenya in 1940. She obtained a degree in biological sciences from Mount St. Scholastica College, now Benedictine College, in Atchison, Kansas, in 1964. She went on to become the first woman in East and Central Africa to earn a doctorate degree. Her life was not without challenges. Maathai and her husband, Mwangi Maathai, divorced in 1979. He was said to have believed that Wangari was too strong-minded for a woman and that he was unable to control her. She developed a grassroots organization called the Greenbelt Movement, facilitating the planting of more than 20 million trees. Although the results of the work were very positive, she was attacked and even imprisoned when her work ran afoul of powerful developers. In 1992, it came to the attention of Maathai that her name was on a list of people targeted for assassination and that a government-sponsored coup was possible. She barricaded herself in her house. After 3 days, the police cut through the security bars on her windows and arrested her on charges of sedition and treason. The charges were dropped after an outpouring of international support. In 2002, she was elected to the Kenyan Parliament with an overwhelming 98% of the vote. She was subsequently appointed by the President as Assistant Minister for Environment, Natural Resources, and Wildlife. Her list of achievements, international awards, and accolades is extensive, including being the first African woman to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. When awarding the prize, the committee praised her holistic approach to sustainable development that embraces democracy, human rights, and women's rights in particular. Wangari Maathai died on September 25, 2011. This has been a Women's History Moment from KKFI, the Ethnic Enrichment Commission, and Baraza.
We're back. This is Joseph Jackson, hosting Cowtown Conversations on 90.1 FM. And today we're celebrating Women's Month, and we're celebrating the achievements of author Christine Taylor Butler, MIT graduate, education advocate, and also activist. So, Christine, when did you decide to finally follow on your childhood dream and become a writer?
Oh, okay. So, you know, the hardest part about, you know, I have an art design degree and I have an engineering degree, and the hardest part about working at Hallmark was that engineering paid more, but the writing and the art side of that industry was just, it was interesting, and I was interacting with artists all the time because I was on the applied side of engineering, so I was having to, yeah. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was having to explain to artists why it was hard to read create some of the things they were doing. You know, there's only so much you can do with them.
Hold on one second. Okay. No, we got a caller. Go ahead and complete.
Okay, with the printing press. And so, you know, here I am thinking, the Hallmark is a family-owned company, and they were making their own dreams come true. And I said, maybe it's time I modeled that for my children. So I left. Thinking, you know, breaking into writing was going to be easy, and it wasn't. But what I was trying to show my kids is pick the thing that you are passionate about and then be good at it. You know, that, you know, it takes work and thousands of hours. But I was working with a lot of other people who were working because they needed to support their families. But then they were going home and doing the thing they were passionate about. And I said, could I make both? Could I do the thing I'm passionate about and turn it into my job?
We've got a caller. Caller, can you tell us your name and what part of town you're calling from and what your question or comment is for Christine?
Yes, Larry, North Kansas City. I believe you have a fascinating guest, and the knowledge that she is spreading is critical. I happen to be from Boston, and I'm familiar with that territory. And my son's an electrical engineer, worked for Jupiter Networks, and the journey begins when he was a little boy. And it's critical that you read to your children when they're babies, when they're small. One of the first books I got him was a library. A dictionary, and he got his library card when he was 5 years old. So, it's sad that the only time that young black men get to travel is if they join the military. I was in the Marine Corps, so I got to travel. But what she's talking about is really gold. You got to start planning way before you get to college, and reading is critical. So, I agree with her 1,000%.
Oh, Larry, I love you. I tell people libraries are free. There are some countries that don't have libraries. So, you know, it is not even about having a book budget. There is this unlimited diet of books, and librarians are amazing advocates for kids if we utilize them. And the more we utilize the library, the more they're able to get more books. You know, they really need the support. So yes, and for those parents where reading is an issue, I go audiobooks. And here's why I recommend audiobooks is because you can then introduce books that are a little bit above their reading level, but they're hearing the words and the language in context. So that's why it's possible to have kids who may not be able to read perfectly, but their vocabulary and their knowledge is advanced because they're absorbing advanced information. And then the third thing I would suggest is a librarian told me this trick with my youngest, who was a reluctant reader, which was put on her favorite shows, turn off the sound, put on the sound of the subtitles, because it forces them to read and it forces them to read fast. So those are that's my advice. But parents are the first best advocate for kids.
Absolutely. They're the first teacher for their children, and you have to hopefully get them to fall in love with reading, and that's the key. But you're doing a fantastic job. I just hope that many other parents would take your lead, and because the journey begins way before college. If you want to go, you can't wait to get to high school. You got to begin in grade school. So thank you for your wisdom, and continue blessings.
Thank you. I'm applauding you. And, you know, here's what book whisperers will tell you, reading specialists. If a book is not right, it's working for a kid, get a different book. You know, the worst way to get a kid to fall in love with reading is to keep shoving books at them they don't want to read. So find that, you know, for my daughter, it was Artemis Fowl and Junie B. Jones. You know what I mean? It was, you find that book that makes them laugh or makes them wonder or makes them curious. And it could be a graphic novel. It could be a comic book. But, you know, find the book that unlocks that kid, because not every book is the right key for every kid. But falling in love with reading so that they are reading even when no one is telling them to read, that is the key to everything.
Absolutely. Well, this is a great show, and I hope to hear you frequently on this show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. So I have to, how many, let's ask this question. How many books have you written, and what types of books do you write?
Oh, okay. So I've written a lot of books. I have published, and that's a misnomer. 90 books of mine have been published by commercial publishers. So Scholastic is probably my biggest publisher. I've done most of my books for them. I have written everything from fiction and nonfiction. I tell teachers, you know, I said, what books have you read? And I said, oh, your kids are already reading my books. You just don't know it, because nobody looks in the back to see what the picture is. I always say I'm from Kansas City. I've read books about space and meteorology and Martin Luther King. And right now I am working on a 3-book series for Random House for Chelsea Clinton. So we are doing the Save the Animals series, and I was under a confidentiality agreement, but they sent out the press releases. So my first book, which is about tigers, Save the Tigers, and how we used to have 100,000 tigers, and now we only have 4,000 living in the wild, is a book that is a book for kids. That'll be out in September. And then I'm doing blue whales and polar bears. There's three of us writing for a Chelsea Clinton series. And then my I have a new book out called The Get Together, about a black family reunion gone wrong. And it is resonating with a lot of people who are not black. They're like, oh, my God, this is my family. And I said, oh, yeah, this is everybody's family. You know, the cheating at Scrabble and the competition over who makes the best recipes. And so they come together in love, and then, you know, they fall apart during all of the competitiveness, and then they come back together when someone turns on the music. And then I am... I completed three of the four books in the Lost Tribe series about five kids who don't know their parents, have been living under a secret identity with the fate of the world and the universe hanging in the balance. And so when people look at my travel schedule, a lot of it, like when I was in Ireland and stuff, is because that book has been really popular with world science fiction and world fantasy. So I call it... Harry Potter meets Spy Kids meets Black Panther is what The Lost Tribes is.
So, Christine, how important is it to work to achieve your dreams and aspirations?
Okay, nobody's going to do it but you. And you're going to get a lot of people who are going, you know, there's work at the post office. This is not easy. I have a lot of people who will call and say, hey, you know, I want to be a writer, and would you mentor me? And I'm going, well, you know, no, because this is actually my full-time job, and I have a mortgage payment to make. So I don't have time to do that. I will answer questions, especially if a librarian sends somebody my way. But here's the example that I heard from Michael Garrett. He used to be Stephen King's first editor. And he said, you know, people want to write, but they don't want to learn. They don't want to learn what it is they don't know about writing. And then they complain that they can't sell their work. And there's a lot of sexism, and there's a lot of racism, and there's a lot of regionalism, because, you know, we're in the Midwest and a lot of publishers are not. But you have to know what you don't know. And so the example that he gave was, you want to be a brain surgeon, but you don't want to go to medical school, and you can't figure out why the patients keep dying. So you get in a critique group of other people who want to be brain surgeons, but also don't read, and, you know, any technical journals, and the bodies keep piling up. And so I said, you have to take a class. And you have to read a lot in the field that you want to do. You want to do robotics, you have to read a lot, and you have to experiment. And a lot of the things that you try are going to fail. But you learn the most through failure. So one piece of advice I would give you is when I'm asked for schools to come out and talk about planets, I'm an engineer, but I'm not a planet expert. You know, I know astronomers. So I found out that NASA, for instance, has educational specialists who will Zoom, you know, for free. And so when I go to these school visits, I would have a NASA expert up on the screen to answer all the questions that I could not answer. And I was learning things that I didn't know. And one of the things we did, science teacher training at Rockhurst, and I said, oh, yeah, I've got to get this NASA expert. And he said, at NASA, the philosophy is, failure is not an option. It is mandatory. You want to know every possible way something can fail before you put a person in space. And so when kids were coming to me in their 12th grade, and they've got straight A's, and they've got perfect ACT and SAT scores, and I would throw curveballs at them to see if they could answer, and I said, you don't understand. College is not about the right answer and what you can regurgitate. College is about the wrong answer and figuring out why it was wrong, and then you go do the research to figure out how you can fix it or how you can make it better. You know, we don't want kids who they read a book and they regurgitate to get an A on a test. We want somebody to say, you know what, that didn't work the way I thought it was going to work. Could I redesign it to be better? And so writing is the same way. I have a lot of stuff in my drawer I probably should burn before I die because it's just terrible. But I was learning to write. And so to support that, Ken and I are one of a number of people who set up scholarships for Highlights Foundation. They do Highlights for Children magazine. They're like Hallmark. They're still family-owned, and the great-grandson is now running them. And we said, I remember having to pull out my credit card so I could pay for their classes. It was worth every penny for me to learn what I was doing well and what I wasn't from experts in the industry. So we set up a scholarship under our name for people who don't have the same means, and so do a lot of other people. So they have about $75,000 worth of scholarships to give away for different categories of people. So I would encourage people who are interested in writing or illustrating for children to look up highlightsfoundation.org. It's the nonprofit foundation associated with Highlights for Children, and their mission is to train children's authors and illustrators to be able to work with their competitors.
So can you repeat that one more time? So in case somebody might have been trying to find a pen or pencil.
Okay, so Highlights. So remember, it's like Highlights for Children. So it's Highlight Foundation, altogether, .org.
So, Christine, a few years back, Venus Williams penned a letter about equal pay for men and women in tennis and at Wimbledon. Is the pay equal for men and women who are authors, or, you know, and what other factors may play an issue in that?
No, and I, you know what, I have been beating up on especially women in general. It's like every job where people don't talk about how they get paid or what they get paid. And I'm going to be really blunt. When I first started in this business, I could make $1,500 writing a 100-word book. 100 words. And you know, 100 words is only a couple of words per page. And there are two ways you write. You can write what's called work for hire, which is a contract. So I'm going to write this story for you. You're going to pay me. You own the story. The second one is royalties, which is I'm going to write the story. You are going to pay me up front in advance for what you think you're going to sell for the first year. And then after you've sold enough books for me to have earned that advance, then I start getting royalties on every additional copy that you make. That's how J.K. Rowling got so rich writing Harry Potter. And so I would do both. You know, if you write a planet book, you know, NASA's always finding new stuff. So once they find new stuff, there needs to be a new book. So those kind of books I would sell on contract. And the reason why this is important is, okay, I got started 20 years ago. My first book published in 2003. It took me 3 years to find out how to write better, how to find a publisher. So $1,500 for 100 words. Now publishers will call and say, we need a 4,000-word research book with sidebars and a bibliography and footnoted, and we will pay you $1,200. And I was going, you know, not in my lifetime will I do that for you. Not in my lifetime. But I would find other authors who desperately, especially women, wanted to say, hey, I'm a children's author. And they would take those jobs. And I said, that's why you can't get paid is, you know, I had someone who called and said, would you write for our series? And I'm reading the book. And I said, you're not selling this very well. It's a retired teacher, but it's not selling. And they said, no, why? And I said, it's a preschool book, and it's written preschool on one page and post-high school on another page, and there's typos. And so I said, I have some time on my hand. I rewrote the book. You know, just for grins, this is what it should look like. And they got very excited and said, hey, you know, we want to hire you to do a 30-book deal. Now, I have two kids in college, so I'm thinking, hot dog, $30. I got college tuition covered. And they said, we can pay like $100 per book. And I said, you want to pay me $3,000 to write you 30 books, which you will then sell to the educational market? And I said, no, not going to do it. And I had colleagues say, you know, pass my name along, I'll do it. And I said, I won't. Because if we don't start talking about why you have to pay your own Social Security and your medical insurance, and you have to create your own retirement plan, I will not pass your name along to a publisher paying like that. But there are a lot of people who do, and so it's become a race to the bottom, and a lot of, especially women authors, need to know their worth, because the men aren't getting paid like that. They're not.
So, Christine, where can people find your books?
Okay, so I'm commercially published, so if it's not on the shelf, any bookstore can order it. I am in the process of revamping my website so I can show you, but, you know, it's available through Barnes & Noble. It is, every book of mine is available through Amazon. I will tell you, Amazon does not treat authors or publishers well. If you have smaller kids, I recommend The Get Together, which is just fun. And it's from a new company called Raycraft, which is Reycraft. But like I said, I'm going to get all of this up on my website. And if you Google my name, all this stuff comes up. But I have not self-published anything. I'm at the point where I have 90 books in print, and so publishers are actually calling me and saying, would you be interested in writing? And so that's essentially where writers want to get to, especially if they don't. I don't have an agent. I've fired two. You have to sell more than I do in order to work for me. but truly, I will tell you, writing for children is the best job I've ever had. It is literally the best job I've ever had.
Christine, As we wind up an hour, what advice do you have for those who are working to achieve their hopes and dreams?
Be good at it. Be willing to admit you're not going to be good at it at the beginning. And remember, it does not have to be perfect in the beginning. Reach out to people who have knowledge about parts of what you're trying to do that you don't have. Don't ask them to mentor you. Please, please, please. That's the biggest way to get somebody to not respond. You know, pay it forward, pay it backwards, but recognize, start today. Even if you've got a job, you know, you take the time to go to a doctor's office, have a little notebook with you. Give yourself, you know, 15 minutes a day to say, this is my plan for the career I wanted to have or the dream I want to have. And then that 15 minutes is sacrosanct. You're not going to pick up the phone. You're not going to turn on the television. You are going to say, I am going to carve out time every week to practice woodworking or practice the piano, or whatever that thing is you want to do. If you don't make time for it, if you don't make time to learn it, because it's going to take years to get to the mastery point. No one's going to make that time for you, but everybody is going to find reasons to pull you away or interrupt you, and you just have to close the door and say, oh, you know what? This 15 minutes, this half hour belongs to Christine and no one else.
So, if you had to pick one thing, what would you say is your greatest accomplishment so far? And what would it be?
My kids. my kids. I actually apologized to my mother for being a difficult child, and she said, You made it up to me. And I said, well, how did I do that? And she said, your kids. So, yeah, my kids are my greatest accomplishment.
As we close out, how important, Christine, is community and working to improve our community?
It's everything. We can't do this stuff by ourselves. We can't. You know, there is a reason why they have that thing that says it takes a village. I have a village for science fiction. I have a village for children's writing. I have a village for all of the neighborhood stuff that's going on. You know, we laugh, we talk, we debate, we argue, but we rally when it's important. So don't think anything that you do out there you have to do by yourself. There are other people who have the same dreams and aspirations. Form a village.
So I want to thank you so much, Christine, for being our initial guest for Women's Month. And again, tell people how they can find your books and where they're located.
Okay, so you can find me on Twitter. I'm Christine TB, or you can find me on my website, which is just ChristineTaylorButler.com. No hyphen, it's just all smushed together. But if you go to Barnes & Noble and type in my name, if you type in Taylor-Butler, I'm the only published author with that last name, and it will come up.
I want to thank Christine for being our guest today. We never end Cowtown Conversations without a community minute. Happy St. Patrick's Day, folks. Be safe, drink responsibly, and stay aware, because the life you save could be your own. For Cowtown Conversations, I've been your host, Joseph Jackson. Join us next week for another episode, as our guest will be Guyetta Payne, who is a local healthcare professional. Have a great day. Stay safe, wear a mask, and stay tuned for My Place with Larry J.
Oh,